You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease Du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Erica Makin about equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation. We discussed diagnostic tools, feeding recommendations, pharmaceutical treatment, ongoing research, and more. This episode of Disease Du Jour is brought to you by Vimeda. Dr. Makin is an assistant professor of equine science in the Department of Animal Science at Texas A&M University, where she teaches graduate equine nutrition and equine health and disease for undergraduate students. She also serves as the faculty advisor for the Horsemen's Association at Texas A&M University. Dr. Makin is an agricultural enthusiast and grew up showing livestock in 4-H. She received her bachelor's in animal science from the University of Florida, where she took part in determining ammonia output volumes from horses fed different concentrations of protein. For her master's and PhD, she focused on equine nutritional endocrinology, more specifically equine metabolic syndrome or insulin dysregulation. Her dissertation serves as the foundation for nutritional recommendations for horses with insulin dysregulation associated with metabolic syndrome. Parts of her dissertation have been cited as the most clinically relevant articles by the Equine Veterinary Education Journal. Upon completion of her PhD, Dr. Makin completed about 1.5 years of postdoctoral training in endocrinology in the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky. At Texas A&M, Dr. Makin investigates what leads to impaired insulin signaling in the endocrine diseased equid. Her primary focus is the development of improved diagnostics and therapies that have the potential to elucidate the mechanisms behind hyperinsulinemia-associated laminitis. Thank you, Dr. Makin, for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to sit in and talk to you guys about equine endocrine disease.
Yeah, I know you're a big expert on this topic, so I'm really excited to have some of your insight. Can you get us started by just giving us a little bit of an overview on what equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation are and how they typically present in horses?
Yeah, of course. So when we think about equine metabolic syndrome, or it's termed as either metabolic syndrome or EMS, this is a collection of symptoms and characteristics that indicate that a horse has a higher likelihood or risk of developing hyperinsulinemia-associated laminitis. And I'll break that down. Hyperinsulinemia-associated laminitis is just laminitis caused by high insulin in the blood. And this is often deemed, because of insulin dysregulation. Because they have a higher likelihood of developing that, they normally, oftentimes other symptoms you'll see is obesity, maybe some changes in blood work, having higher triglycerides in the blood. And they'll have, with just general obesity, they'll even have regional fat deposits on the neck, around the tail head, behind the withers. They seem kind of fluffy and you can't really palpate the ribs that well. And because most of those horses have insulin dysregulation, and that's a collective term for both hyperinsulinemia, either at rest or after they eat something, and tissue insulin resistance, which just refers to the inability of the tissues to respond to a normal amount of insulin. So then the body kicks out a bunch of insulin and tries to get the response from the different tissues. And by response, I mean, moving and shuttling glucose into the different tissues. So a horse does not have to have metabolic syndrome to have insulin dysregulation. And what I mean by that is that we see a lot more horses nowadays that are actually lean when you think about on a body condition score. They can be anywhere from a 4 to a 5, which in 5 is like ideal, right? You have a little bit of cushion, but you may see a few ribs. But some of these horses just have regional fat and they're not overly obese. And most owners don't catch those types of horses that have insulin dysregulation because outwardly they seem fine. But the ones that do present as like morbidly obese, oftentimes your veterinarian or maybe even a feed sales rep that comes out to the barn or something, they'll be like, yeah, this horse has metabolic syndrome. So there's you know, two sides of that. They can be fat. They don't have to be fat. They can have insulin dysregulation in both cases. Veterinarians can look at the hormones in your horse at either resting or after a challenge and determine if your horse has metabolic syndrome or insulin dysregulation. So again, today we now know that high levels of insulin in the blood can induce a laminitic event. However, there are different forms of laminitis, which more people are accustomed to, like carbohydrate overload or, you know, supporting limb laminitis and stuff like that. This is very different from that.
Okay. Are those lean horses still at an equal risk of laminitis as the obese horses?
You know, there hasn't been any studies that would, you know, definitively say that they are, because they're harder to find.
Right.
But I would, for just the sake of being safe, I would say that those lean horses are at the same risk to developing laminitis as morbidly obese horses.
Okay. Are there any specific breeds or life stages that veterinarians should be particularly vigilant about when it comes to metabolic diseases, and especially in identifying these horses that aren't typical presenters with obesity?
Yeah, so there's been a bunch of breed work by different researchers and clinician scientists. And when we think about which breeds are more susceptible, we think about gated breeds like Pasifinos, Tennessee Walkers, more like your thrifty breeds, so like Mustangs, and then you have Morgans, Halflingers, Warmbloods. You know, they're most of the time those guys, if you have a patient presented to a veterinarian or a client presented to an equine nutritionist, we do take breed into account, because some of these breeds are just, you know, if you look at them funny, they'll develop metabolic syndrome.
Right.
And, you know, my corgi is the same way. If I look at her funny, she'll gain 2 pounds. So breeds are definitely like a first indication. Knowing that we have those genetics, that means that those breeds could be more predisposed to developing obesity and then metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation. Now, when it comes to age, it can happen at any age. I've seen it in as young as a 3-year-old, which you wouldn't think, because they're still growing, that they wouldn't be putting either muscle mass or fat deposits at such a young age, but they can. And then they can go all the way through to even senior horses. Most of the time we see the senior horses have concurrent disease like pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction, or what's previously been known as Cushing's. Those guys are more apt to develop insulin dysregulation if they have already developed Cushing's disease. But I would say that most horses develop insulin dysregulation in their like teen years, anywhere from 10 to 15, or is normally about when I see people really struggling with a metabolic horse. And normally that's because in that part of their life, they have the environmental factors that go into that is that they have a sedentary lifestyle, or they have lots of nutrition. It kind of just, you kind of set that horse up to fail and developing these metabolic problems. So if you have a breed that is more predisposed to developing it, plus you have the environmental factors that will, you know, open the door for that, then those chances for that horse to develop metabolic syndrome and subsequent laminitis are much, much higher than that.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Today's episode of the Disease Azure podcast is brought to you by Buy Me to Equine. Bimeda might be the biggest animal health company you've never heard of until now. Bimeda's products have been trusted by veterinarians and owners since the 1960s, when their Irish roots began. Bimeda is one of the largest producers of dewormers like Equimax, Bimectin, and Exodus. World-renowned equine athletes also rely on polyglycan, a patented formula that replaces lost or damaged synovial fluid, and Confidence EQ pheromone gel, which reduces and prevents equine stress. Consult your vet and visit bimedaus.com to see where to buy. Can we talk a little bit now about diagnostic techniques? What are some of the most reliable options, and how does season impact results?
Yeah, so this particular field of equine nutritional endocrinology has really taken off since, I'd probably say, 2002 is when it was first defined by Johnson and colleagues, and then 2010 was the first consensus statement. So it's still a relatively new area of research, and it's always changing every year. And one group of researchers called the Equine Endocrinology Group, it is run out of Tufts University, I believe. It has a bunch of researchers that do all the work in these different fields, and it develops recommendations for diagnosing, treatment, and then what type of assays to use in order to quantify those hormones. So we were using, back in the day, we're using clamps, which are very, very expensive and not very conducive to field medicine. And then there's always what people use now is just resting. So they'll come out to do, like, you know, maybe it's a preventative visit, and your veterinarian comes out to give you your horse vaccines and draw Coggins and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. Well, they can take blood from that visit and have insulin and ACTH, which is the hormone that corresponds with Cushing disease, and look at those values. And we have thresholds, like basically ranges, you know, whenever you yourself gets blood drawn, you have like a range of what's considered normal, what's considered abnormal. We have those same ranges for these different hormones. The problem with looking at resting values is that season and other environmental factors can affect that level of insulin, which can be a problem depending upon what month or what season you go to diagnose your horse in. So, for example, I did some seasonal work where I did a 2-year longitudinal study in metabolic and healthy horses in Kentucky, which, of course, you know, Kentucky has very different topography compared to Texas or, you know, Florida or something like that. So it might be different. It might differ between states. But in general, what I found was that in the late fall, early winter and spring, metabolic horses had higher insulins compared to, you know, summer and early fall. So if you are, you know, maybe your horse is due for vaccines and stuff in the summertime in July or something, and you have your vet come out and they take resting blood samples, they may not actually identify that your horse has insulin dysregulation, because maybe that's in when it's at its low value. That's why I always recommend to have horses diagnosed for insulin dysregulation either in the late fall, winter, or in the spring, because ideally that's when their resting insulins would be at their highest. An additional thought to that is that not all insulin dysregulated horses have resting hyperinsulinemia or high insulin in the blood. So we like to use the oral sugar test to really identify which horses have that exaggerated post-challenge response. But of course, that takes time for a veterinarian to perform, because they have to take a resting sample, then they have to dose that horse with Karo syrup, which, you know, there's worse things to be dosed with. That's just very, very sugary treat. And then they'll take a sample 60 minutes later and see how high that insulin was able to go. It basically mimics a carbohydrate meal for a horse, but because it's in such a bioavailable form, we can look at it at 60 minutes and get a rough idea of what the, you know, post-meal insulin is for these horses. So really, you have to be careful when it comes to what diagnostic tools you use and what season. For horses that have severe insulin dysregulation, they oftentimes will have resting hyperinsulinemia as well as post-meal hyperinsulinemia, and you can easily identify those. But for the ones that don't have resting hyperinsulinemia, you have to do an oral sugar test on those animals to figure out that they actually do have insulin dysregulation. So it makes it even harder when you have a horse that's on the lean side and you don't even suspect it. I've been saying this for a couple years now, but I think insulin and ACTH should be a part of, like, looking at them should be part of preventative measures for horses moving forward. But of course, you know, that's an added cost, and we all know the veterinarian tends to get a bit pricey the more things you tack on. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Would you recommend the oral sugar test as a first line preventative test, or would that be more so for a suspected case that doesn't test positive on blood work?
I mean, I ideally, if the owner is willing to pay for it, I'd say that would be a first line just to make sure. And of course, make sure that you're doing it at the right time. Because if not, then you may get a response that isn't indicative of disease when the horse actually does have disease.
Okay. Are there any emerging biomarkers or diagnostic approaches that might be coming down the pipeline in the future that could improve diagnostics?
You know, in the past, I'd say, let's see, it's probably been about 3 or 4 years. There was a couple companies that developed like SNAP testing. You know, like when you take your dog into the vet, they do a heartworm test and they'll send it off or there's a little SNAP test. You drop a bit of blood and a reagent on this little SNAP test and then you push it down and then you get a result, you know, like 10, 20 minutes later. There were a couple companies that developed these SNAP tests, but for insulin, which were, you know, really promising because if you have to have your horse tested, your vet has to go out or you have to take your horse to the vet. And, you know, sometimes we wish that it was just a more or a quicker way just to do it by the stall. So the SNAP tests are out there. A lot of people can talk to their veterinarians to see if they could, you know, if you have a metabolic animal that you want to check on more frequently than your vet comes out, you guys could, you know, work out doing those SNAP tests. Now, when it comes to biomarkers, there hasn't really been any new biomarkers, but there are some emerging studies that might have one. And I plan on doing a study this summer with my graduate student, because a lot of people are starting now to look at the hormone dopamine, which is what most people think is a neurotransmitter, but it's actually made and synthesized all across the body. And it's now been shown as a negative regulator of insulin secretion. So, you know, stopping insulin from being released. But those studies are in their infancy. If that leads to a new biomarker, that would be great. But we're still trying to figure out how to measure this hormone within blood because we don't have an assay to do it just yet. So hopefully in the next couple of years, either myself or, you know, one of my colleagues could try to develop this type of assay.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to follow that research in the future and see what comes of it.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
So moving on to dietary recommendations, I'd love to hear your recommendations for how to feed metabolic horses and also if there are any common feed mistakes that you witness.
Yeah. I did a lot of work in this area, so much so that I vividly remember sitting in a lab with a Walmart coffee grinder and grinding different feeds down to try to get different levels of NSC or non-structural carbs. And I did that for over a year trying to develop diets. So painstakingly, I remember everything. So when we think about what dietary recommendations we need to give for insulin dysregulated horses. And the first is just we need to limit their overall non-structural carbohydrate intake, or NSC, also known as sugar and starch. And you should do that across all the feedstuffs that your horse gets. So if they're on some type of commercial concentrate, what forage they're getting, and as well as trying to monitor if they're on pasture or not. Equine nutritionists take this matter very seriously because the research has shown that insulin responses following meals with high NSC increase the likelihood of that horse developing laminitis. So hence why I did all those projects to try to figure out where those thresholds for NSC really are. And because before, fun fact, you might have heard of this too. Did you ever hear that you should keep a horse that has metabolic syndrome under like 12% NSC?
Yeah.
That phrase came out of a paper that was not actually conducted in metabolic horses. It was conducted on polysaccharide storage myopathy, or PSSM, horses.
Oh.
And we just, the authors that did that study, they made that sentence in their discussion. And that's where our 12% or 10% of limiting NSC came from. It actually didn't come from horses with metabolic syndrome. So that's why I did my studies. And we didn't go off of percentage basis. We went off of a grams per kilogram body weight, which in the States, no one uses those particular metrics, but I have some, I could share with some calculations and stuff that I came from those. But we did see that they were very sensitive to sugar and starch. With starch, they're more sensitive to starch than sugar. And I think it was 0.1 grams of NSC per kilogram body weight. And past that, they would have an exaggerated response to whatever feed stuff, whether it was forage, whether it was a ground up commercial concentrate. Just saying that, again, they really do need to have this limited. For commercial feeds, unless your horse needs extra calories to maintain their body condition, you know, if they don't need extra calories, I say put them on a ration balancer, just so you're meeting their protein, their vitamins, and their minerals, and the forage that they're on should take care of the rest. Now, if you have a metabolic horse that is not maintaining their body condition, so say, for example, you have a senior horse that has Cushing's, and they also have insulin dysregulation, but they're a body condition of like a 4, so you can see their ribs. They probably need a little bit more energy reserves on them. Then you want to switch to a feed that says, you know, low NSC on it and feed based off of the feed tag recommendations, because that's going to give a little bit more in terms of fat and fiber that the horse can work off in producing energy and turning that into fuel reserves. So for either one of these, the ration balancer or those low NSC commercial concentrates, they should be at least be split into 2 meals, or if you can swing the managerial aspect and make it into 3 or 5 meals, that's even better, because the problem and what we're trying to avoid is if they get this massive carbohydrate meal, then they're going to have this really exaggerated response to that meal. And if we can limit the volume of that meal, then maybe we can decrease the response to it. So it's not that the fact that they're not going to get all that NSC all at one time. It's you're splitting it across, so maybe that response isn't so high. And when we think about what type of grass or what type of hay, I like a warm season grass hay. Of course, that's not available in every state. But the ones that I can think of the top of my head are, you know, like Teff or Bermuda. If you only have access to cold season grass like Timothy or Fescue, I would recommend soaking that hay and removing the water, because the water will leach all the sugar out of it. And those cold season grass hays tend to have more sugar content to them than anything. And if possible, if you don't have to soak it, feed the hay in like a slow feeder or something like that. This by itself will lower those exaggerated insulin responses. For treats, I know I'm guilty myself, because my 2 off the track thoroughbreds love them some peppermints. And I keep them in my pocket when I'm at the barn. But it's not ideal to give metabolic horses treats. And there was a study that was, I don't remember what journal it was in, but they did show that even giving horses treats that were metabolic, it did affect their insulin levels. So even if it's just, you know, here or there, it still does matter. When it comes to pasture, we think about the sugars and stuff that are in grass. And this could vary depending on what geographical location you are. So I'm not as horribly worried about horses down here in Texas, because it's warm season grasses, as I am horses up in Kentucky and Ohio that have these luscious grasses. I like horses to be turned out in the early morning and be put up midday, because the sugars are going to be there at their highest in the afternoon, because they've been photosynthesizing all day and they're increasing those sugar reserves. And then they'll start depleting them as they go at the nighttime, because they're going to be using those sugars. So in the morning, they should be depleted enough to where they're not as high. And of course, I recommend putting a grazing muzzle on, because that will decrease their intake by roughly about 30%. So that's just another added thing. Biggest mistakes when it comes to feeding metabolic horses. I always see people giving treats, and that's not helpful. I see a lot of people that they think that since they're using a low sugar, low starch hay, they won't soak it. And for horses that are like undergoing a laminitic event or coming off of one, I'd still recommend soaking the hay. And then I don't see them really incorporating like slow feeders either. You know, if you're boarding your horse, you know, sometimes the boarding barn doesn't want to, they just want to throw something in because they're feeding so many horses. But this is super important because for those horses, they're not going to be getting that much because you're wanting restricting, at least for the obese ones, you're restricting those calories. And it's not ideal for those horses to have an empty stomach because they do have a bunch of acid up in their stomach and they could develop ulcers if you're not careful, or they could be developing, you know, the what we call stereotypies or behaviors that aren't good. They'll, you know, box weave and, you know, all those things, or crib. So it's just trying to incorporate all the different managerial things for a metabolic horse. And it's most often I see owners really just, they feel bad because their horse isn't getting that much and they don't seem happy because they're not always out all the time like other horses are. But if you want to try to limit that risk to laminitis, for some horses, that these are the really strict recommendations you have to sit by. And I always feel bad because the owners, they'll either call me or we'll be emailing back and forth, and they'll just say, I wish I could give her more stuff. And I'm like, I know, but maybe if we can get her over this hurdle, we can think about something else. But I think I touched on every part of your question.
Can you talk about the role of exercise in managing these horses?
So the problem is that some horses that are undergoing a laminitic event, you can't actually exercise those horses. You just have to monitor and really be strict about what they're eating. And then even when that horse is coming off being lame, you know, you gotta edge, like, or, you know, slowly work them back into it. But we do know that exercise drastically helps tissue insulin sensitivity and helps burn fat tissue. And we need to get the fat tissue off of them. And what I mean by insulin sensitivity is that the body is more sensitive to the responding to the actions of insulin. So you can move glucose around and, you know, lower your insulin responses. If you have an overweight horse that is sound, you know, like, now is the time to exercise them before a laminitic event occurs. For horses, based off of the equine endocrinology group, previously laminitic horses should be exercised at a low intensity on a soft surface. So, you know, don't trot them over concrete or something. And ideally, we want about 5 minutes walking, 15 minutes of like brisk trotting. And you want that about, you know, 5 days a week if you can. Sometimes that's not always conducive. If the horse has ID and needs to lose weight and there's no signs of laminitis, they could do anything from low to moderate intensity, still exercising, you know, roughly about 5 days a week. And what I mean by low to moderate intensity is that, you know, you could go for anywhere from a canter to a fast canter that could be ridden, unridden, just under a lunge line. And you do that for about 30 minutes. So those are normally the two different ones that I say. But of course, not every insulin dysregulated horse is obese, but I would still recommend for the lean horses to exercise them, because in human medicine, we see that people that exercise regularly have better insulin glucose dynamics. So even though that horse isn't necessarily losing weight and you're just trying to keep them fit, you're also keeping your tissues fit in a way. So regardless whether your horse is obese or not, you should still be exercising, even if it's just lunging.
Right. That's great advice. And then at what point is it appropriate to consider pharmaceutical intervention?
Yeah. And this is a big area that's kind of exploded within the past 6 to 9 months. And when we think about a horse that is showing signs of laminitis and they're not improving, you know, over a few days with, you know, anti-inflammatories and things like that, and we still see that their insulins are super, super high, now we have these things called SGLT2 inhibitors. They have some really long names, hard to pronounce, like dapagliflozin, eryctoflozin, but Drs. Rendell and Sundra presented at the American Association of Equine Practitioners this past December that these drugs are extremely helpful for horses that are undergoing a laminitic event. It helps by taking that glucose out of the blood and trying to keep insulin levels lower, because insulin, you have to remember that insulin helps shuttle glucose into respective tissues. So if there's no glucose circulating in the blood, the insulin isn't going to be released as much. So a lot of veterinarians are seeing great, great responses to SGLT2 inhibitors. And I think that they're our best tool right now in terms of pharmaceuticals to help a currently laminitic horse, try to get them through that episode. And, you know, hopefully they're at the laminitic stage and not at the foundering stage. And so I see, at least from the veterinarians I've talked to recently, if they do have a horse that presents with, you know, high resting insulin concentrations, their first go-to is looking at these SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yeah, that's an exciting development. I think that's going to help a lot of horses.
I agree.
So in our last few minutes here, I would love to just talk about some of the research that you've been involved with on hyperinsulinemia-associated laminitis. Can you just talk briefly about some of this work that you've been doing and how you think this might impact clinical practice in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a researcher, you have a lot of irons in the fire and you're just hoping one of them takes off. So I have a bunch of different avenues that I'm going down and hoping that one of them, you know, kind of sticks. I'm currently working with a company to release a national survey, gearing towards trying to quantify endocrine disease in the United States, because we know those numbers in Australia and Europe, but we don't have a good idea of what those numbers are here in the US. We also don't understand what owners, their education on these diseases are. So that's one of my projects, trying to figure out how can we help horse owners that have endocrine diseased animals. And is there, in that survey, I'm asking them about their nutrition, how they were diagnosed, and different managerial things that they do that work, that don't work. So we can try to get that information into a really nice, pretty manuscript and maybe learn some stuff from it. One of my bigger projects that happening this summer is looking at the impact of dopamine on insulin dysregulation and trying to see what its role is in the physiological flow of insulin dysregulation. Currently, there's been a group of people over in Australia that have released two different papers on this topic, and they're really, you know, their work has guided me into what I wanted to do. So that's a different area. I also do more practical stuff. So looking at improving our feeding recommendations. So I've been looking at what does incorporating, you know, a processed forage into a concentrate meal, because a lot of people, and I'm sure you're probably familiar, you'll have people that'll feed alfalfa pellets with whatever, you know, commercial grain your horse is on.
Right.
Or they'll put cubes in, you know, it just, you know, but what does that do to a horse that has metabolic syndrome? Is that helpful? Is it, you know, do we take those insulin responses and hike them up even more? Another area is looking at exercise and insulin dysregulation. And if we can modulate insulin sensitivity with exercise in those horses. And I'm also, another area is looking at the circadian clock and looking and see if that helps, either helps metabolic parameters or if it doesn't. And by that, you know, horses are seasonal breeders, so they go through hormonal changes every season. And we're trying to see if we can manipulate some of those circadian patterns and help with metabolism and insulin and glucose dynamics. I'm sure I'm forgetting a project, but those are some of the big ones that I have on my whiteboard that sits behind me.
No, that's really exciting work, and I'm looking forward to following that as you continue your work, because I think this is just really improved care options for these horses, and so many horses are affected by this, so it's definitely going to have a big impact on veterinary medicine. And
yeah, I hope so.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us on this episode. I think this has been a great overview and really nice to hear more about some of your work.
Thank you again for inviting me, and I'm happy to share.
I want to say thank you again to Dr. Makin for joining us, and thank you to Vimeda for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning into the podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please send me an email at csysin@equinenetwork.com.